I'm Katie, mom to two littles and four angel babies.
And I'm Sarah, an advocate for moms and children of all backgrounds and family types.
With two PhDs between us and collective decades spent unraveling how society shapes women's experiences, we're here to shred the rule books and their relentless tide of expectations. In this safe space, the complexities of motherhood find the candid, unfiltered voice. We're Undefining Motherhood, one conversation at a time. One thing that stood out during my recurrent miscarriage journey was how ill-equipped most people are to validate and support grief. Unsure what to say, they look for a bright side or a silver lining, turning to advice and platitudes that do no one any good. Now, let me be clear. No one ever meant me any harm in the words they chose. It's just that we're only in recent years beginning to build a language around reproductive struggles, and we still have a long way to go in learning how to support people through them. If you've never experienced fertility struggles, you're probably wondering what the heck I'm even talking about. But if you've been through infertility or loss, I bet your head is spinning right now with the memories of all the at leasts and justs and advice about God only knows what that you heard over and over again. And that's what we're here to talk about today. Because however well-intended, moms are bombarded with so much advice that often makes them feel isolated, broken, and even shameful. We'll be talking about harmful advice in the next few episodes. And in this episode, we're going deep into one specific piece of advice our infertility and loss moms have heard far too many times. Just relax. We chose this one for a very specific reason. So listen up, because this is important. Telling someone experiencing infertility or miscarriage to just relax makes them feel misunderstood, alone, and it inherently blames them for their struggles, which, just to be clear, are and never were caused by stress alone, though we have a long history of believing differently, and we're going to tell you about it. Keep listening as we deep dive into language, psychology, and of course, some fascinating tidbits of history, ultimately learning how we can do better. By the end of this episode, you'll also be equipped with a toolbox of knowledge and things you can do and say that actually are supportive. The topic's hard, but I promise you'll find yourself laughing and maybe also crying a little as you listen along. When I was experiencing fertility struggles and miscarriage, all of these well-intended comments from family, friends, strangers, everybody alike, it seemed like, made me feel like I was somehow to blame, like the issues I was experiencing were my fault. And it's time to change how we talk to women about their motherhood experiences and get rid of that self-blame around fertility struggles and pregnancy loss.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people just love to give advice.
They do.
We've talked about that a lot.
And they love to give advice. You know, we hear a lot about, I was talking to Dr. Jessica Zucker about this recently, and she's actually going to be on a future episode of ours. And she was saying, we just don't have a language around how to talk to people about loss and grief in this particular kind of way.
Right, because women's bodies are shameful.
Exactly.
And anything that happens to them is taboo.
Exactly. So, you know, we hide them away. We don't talk about these things. We pretend they didn't happen. And so then we feel like, well, we must have done something wrong if we need to hide it. And for me, this...
Yeah, what's your favorite bit of advice, Katie?
Oh, God. I mean, I could go on for hours. But the one that I think really hits when it comes to thinking about blame was I got it the most frequently when I was pregnant after a miscarriage. And, you know, I had four miscarriages in a row before I had a successful pregnancy. So I was pregnant after a miscarriage many, many, many times before I finally had my living baby. And people would say to me all the time, just relax. Mm. And this time it'll be different. And then this time wasn't different.
True.
And then the next time they would say it again. And the next time they would say it again. And so it made me feel really isolated and alone in this situation, because it felt like this reminder that people didn't understand where I was
and that they didn't even know how to try to support me mm-hmm. through that space.
Or they didn't want to try?
Sometimes I definitely felt like they didn't want to try. You know, I think when it comes to how we support someone through grief, it all comes down to emotional intelligence. And some of that is innate. Some of it we have learned. Some of it we have tried to learn ourselves. Others we've been taught. So for some people, it felt like you could have the capacity for this, and you don't. And for other people, it felt like you just really don't understand. And so what I kept finding myself doing was saying, please don't say that to me. Mm-hmm. I understand your well-intentioned, but the reality is, one, me relaxing has nothing, zero, to do with whether this pregnancy succeeds. And number two, you don't know what's going to happen. So telling me it will be different this time makes me feel like you're not a trusted person.
Yeah, it just sets you up for failure if something doesn't go well.
Exactly.
Like, what if you totally relax and you still have another miscarriage?
Exactly.
What does that do?
I can't just relax.
Yeah.
It's not my personality.
Have you met Katie?
Hello, generalized anxiety disorder.
Right, yeah, totally.
But also, yeah, it's just, even if I did that, no one, we can't predict anyone's future.
Yeah.
We can't predict anyone's outcome. And this is why it's so difficult. You know, all my friends struggling with infertility talk about the same thing. People say just relax as if that's going to make the difference. And it makes them feel, I mean, they tell me daily, like, it's so you're telling me this is my fault somehow that if I relax more, I would actually be able to get pregnant. And it's just, I mean, it's just factually not true, but it's also hard. You know, what I actually did, and this, people tell me all the time that I'm amazing at setting personal boundaries. And they're like, how do you do it? Will you teach me? I have been invited into pregnancy after miscarriage groups or miscarriage groups to specifically talk about setting personal boundaries. Mm-hmm. And they say, how do you do it? And the answer is, honestly, I've always been horrifically bad at it. And sometimes I still am. But I learned it during the recurrent miscarriage and pregnancy after a miscarriage time. And so I'll wrap up with this story because I just think it's such a pertinent one to show how we can kind of set these boundaries. My mom, God bless her. Love you, Mom. I know you're listening to this.
We love Kathy.
Hi, Kathy. She tries so hard to be supportive and empathetic, and we have a lovely relationship, which is why it was extra hard for me when she didn't know how to support me the way that I needed during this time. And to her credit, she learned, and she worked really hard to learn, and ultimately was a major support system. And postpartum, I genuinely don't know if I could have survived without her. But when I got pregnant with Jack, by this point, I was announcing pregnancies as soon as I found out about them, only to the people who I wanted to support me if I were to lose the pregnancy, right? So you always knew, and you always found out through text message, because what I did is I would text all my people, my core people, right? And I would be like, hey, we're in it again.
Right.
Got a positive test this morning. I'm feeling terrified. I just want you to know where I am for whatever happens. And most of the responses I got to that were hearts and, you know, just a little heart on the iPhone. And that was perfect. That was all I needed. But at this point, we had gone through fertility treatments. I'd had a surgery that had found and fixed a problem. I'd been on rounds of antibiotics to fix a different problem. I was taking a lot of medication to account for possible problems that we didn't know for sure if they existed or not. But my doctor just called it the kitchen sink approach. We're going to do these things in case. Yeah. Turns out we probably needed to. So thank God he did. So I knew that when I announced this pregnancy, there was going to be a level of hope that there had never been mm-hmm. before. And so
– And that hope puts pressure on you, right?
It puts much pressure on you because people expect you to be hopeful and excited and joyful.
And you want to be.
But after loss, so many moms aren't. And after nothing but loss, my brain didn't know how to process that there could be a good ending. Like, that didn't even register as a possibility subconsciously. So – it was really hard. And so what I actually did, because I didn't want to tell my parents via text message. I think they're the only people I didn't tell via text message. I called my dad. And I said,
tell him to prep your mom.
I did. I said, hey, Daddy,
I love it.
Is mama around? And he said, no, she's in the shower. And I was like, perfect. Right. So here's the deal. I'm pregnant again. We're going in for blood work later today, and we'll follow it for the next few weeks. You know the drill. You know how this goes. I need for you to tell mama, and I need you to tell her that as much as I love her and I want her to experience joy and excitement about this announcement, I don't want her to contact me until she can not be excited, because I just can't right now. To my mom's credit, it took her like 10 minutes.
But she needed those 10 minutes to process it.
She needed those 10 minutes to remind her to be excited and to think, oh my gosh, maybe this time will be different. And then to prep herself to not say to me, maybe this time will be different.
And ultimately, that boundary is kind to her too, right?
It is.
It makes her process. It makes her respond to you in a way that is more helpful to you. It's just better for everybody.
Exactly. But, yeah. And I think that's the huge point, because when we think about all of these things that people say to someone going through infertility, going through pregnancy loss, pregnancy after loss, that are hurtful, they don't mean for them to be hurtful.
Of course not.
In the vast majority of cases, I'm there somewhere, I wonder. But you know, they don't mean to hurt you or to upset you.
Most of your close family and friends don't mean to.
They don't mean to. And yet, there is this chasm between you now that you're going to remember. I can tell these stories. It's been 7, 8 years, and I can tell the stories. I remember my emotions. I remember the room I was in. I remember who was in the shower. I remember that my parents were at the beach, because I'm picturing where my dad's sitting. Like, these things stick with you. And so I think if we can talk about what comments are hurtful, why they're hurtful, and what we can do better, we're really going to set everybody up for a better experience, for healthier relationships.
Yes, definitely. It's not just about you.
Exactly. It's not just about me. It's about everyone. Okay, so here's what I want to do.
I'm ready.
Before we get in, I want to play a game of, like, things people say after miscarriage or infertility poker. Okay.
Oh God, okay.
So Sarah and I have both made a list.
Yep, I'm ready.
We are going to, like, see if we can one-up each other. Okay? See if we can get the worst one. All right. So I think you go first.
Okay. So we did Just Relax and It'll Happen.
Uh-huh.
Love that.
Okay, Just Relax and It'll Happen. All right, so worse than that for sure. Well, not worse than that, just different. I love this one. My friend started doing fertility yoga and she got pregnant.
Yay, ooh, that's great for her. Okay, how about just adopt?
Ooh.
There are tons of kids out there who need homes.
Because adoption is
super inexpensive, unproblematic.
Okay, yeah. Okay, how about this one? Acupuncture solved infertility for my cousin's best friend's sister's maid of honor. Have you tried that?
God. Okay, this one's terrible. It applies to people who are experiencing secondary infertility.
Uh-huh.
Just be thankful for the child you already have.
Oh my God. So many people in the undefining motherhood community are like, they're hearing that one. Right. They feel that. Oh, because one child does not replace another. Okay, how about this? This one makes me furious for people struggling with conceiving. You should try IVF. I've heard you get to pick the baby you want.
Whew.
These are all real comments that either we've heard or people, our friends or community have heard. Okay.
This one's rough. At least you weren't further along.
We're going to have to do a whole episode on that one day. Okay. We're from the South. I got a lot of very religious comments. I got this one. God needed your baby more than you did.
Okay. All right. How about you must not have been ready
Oh,
to have a baby.
Oh.
Yeah.
You're winning on that one. But you know what? I think I still have the trump card. I think I got it. You ready for this? This one came straight from a member of the Undefining Motherhood Instagram community. And she said that one of her friends said to her, you ready for this? Well, I heard you were on birth control, so you probably killed your baby.
Oh, my God. Like, what do you even?
What? Even. So, like, we could go on for years about this, right? We could go on for years. So let's talk about it. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about why advice like just relax or try again or be thankful for what you have, why this advice is so problematic.
Which okay. one do you want to focus on? Because we've got a lot going on.
We got
on
a lot. Okay, so today we're going to focus on just relax.
All right.
Because that's one that I think no matter what you're experiencing, if it's infertility, if it's pregnancy loss, you have heard this. So this
even
is
if you're
one.
Just like a type A woman, you've probably heard this.
Oh gosh, it's true. Yeah. So just relax is what we're going to focus on. And you know what? We need to focus on the fact that there's one major issue. And that one major issue is that this comment does not meet you where you are in the moment. And that manifests with so many types of problems. So let's dig into them.
All right, I'm ready.
This episode is sponsored by Genate by SNP Therapeutics, providing genetics-powered nutrition tailored for every stage of the fertility, pregnancy, and postpartum journeys. Now, friend, I tend to get excited about things, but I am not even kidding you when I say that I cried. Real, literal tears when I saw the ingredient list in Genate's new prenatal vitamin. Their essential prenatal multivitamin is the culmination of groundbreaking research and a deep understanding of what moms and growing babies truly need. And here's what that means. Genetic research shows that many women don't get the nutrition they need, even if they eat a balanced diet and take a prenatal supplement. And this is because of genetic misspellings that impair their body's ability to metabolize certain nutrients. Genate has taken this into account in their formulations by designing a supplement with the most bioavailable nutrients in the correct amounts for your baby's development and health. And when paired with the Genate test, you can learn about your personalized genetics to know if there are extra supplements or foods you should be adding to your daily regimen. I am obsessed with the deal they're offering if you get the bundle, including the Genate test and their essential prenatal vitamin subscription. Check them out at undefiningmotherhood.com/Genate and use code undefiningmotherhood10 for 10% off.
So always these things can manifest, right? I think the place we need to start is blame, right? So many moms going through loss and fertility experience self-blame. I know that it was something I struggled with. Heck, it was in Michelle Obama's book. What's her name from The Big Bang Theory? Melissa Rauch.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. She talked about it on Instagram a lot, which was awesome. Like, heck, even James Vanderbeek from Dawson's Creek has talked about it. Like, there's a lot of feelings of self-blame. And it comes, I believe, in part from these comments like, just relax. Yeah, so I think
if you would just relax.
If you would just relax,
you'd be fine.
What you're saying to someone is, well, maybe if you'd been less stressed, you would have conceived. Maybe if you'd been less stressed, you would have been able to carry that baby instead of miscarrying. And while that is factually very inaccurate, also, it causes these real feelings of guilt and blame, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I've got some pretty interesting statistics about this.
I want to hear.
Okay. So a 2015 national survey published in the Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology found that 40% of people who've had a miscarriage feel guilty.
47% of people who've had a miscarriage feel guilty. Yep. And I'm willing to bet that some of those respondents were lying because based on the thousands of moms I've worked with, that number feels low.
Higher, yeah.
Yeah.
So 41% felt that they had done something wrong to cause the pregnancy loss.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Those are people who are miscarrying, right?
Uh-huh.
And then 76% of Americans, just in general, believe that pregnancy loss is caused by a stressful event. So that goes along with your just relax theory.
Oh, right? My goodness. Mm-hmm.
64% believe it's caused by the pregnant person lifting a heavy object.
Was this study?
2015.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. 28% of people believe previously using an intrauterine device causes miscarriages. So if you've had an IUD.
But you don't currently.
Right.
Just having had one ever.
Yeah, ever in your life.
Oh, right. My God.
And 22% of people blame the use of oral contraceptives, according to this survey.
Oh.
Which goes back to your...
That last one that we said. Well, you were on birth control. And that's the thing with miscarriage when you weren't trying to conceive with accidental pregnancies is a lot of times people will really devalue those experiences. Like, oh, well, you didn't want it anyway. It's not a big deal. Mm-hmm. Even though for a lot of families it is a big deal. So
it's just like a can't win for losing approach.
Yes. It's exactly what it is. Oh, my, that is staggering. So people still today, I mean, I understand from working with lost moms and being a lost mom, right, that we feel guilty. But usually what I am hearing when people talk about feeling guilty is – They can't pinpoint why they feel guilty. They just do. And some of them will say, so-and-so made this comment that made me feel like maybe I had done something wrong. But most of them are not pinpointing a specific thing. With a few, there are exceptions for sure. I've heard, well, maybe I shouldn't have had any coffee at all. Yeah, I thought one cup a day was fine. Right. I drank alcohol during the 2-week wait before I knew. Yeah. Like, and none of this is it. Oh, my gosh. But so you're telling me that now, still, today, the majority of Americans believe that stress causes
76%.
Holy moly. I'm going to try to keep my language child-friendly in case kids are in the car. Okay. So I want to go back to where this all came from, right? Because this is – we're the history
nerds. Wheelhouse,
Yes, this is my wheelhouse. Like, what happened?
I'm ready.
So – I told this story of Dr. Tilt, and let me just give, like, a quick overview of that, and then I'm going to add some things that I think are pertinent here. So this was a president in the 1800s, 50s, 60s, 70s, the president of the London Obstetrical Society. So we're talking, like, one of the top OBs in England, which was like world powerhouse at this point in time. So we're in theory, theoretically, we're talking one of the top obstetricians in the world, right? In serious theory, okay? So he was renowned for blaming his patients. He wrote very publicly about what his patients had experienced, and he was I've read so many of his letters, memos, medical pamphlets, newspaper articles, like, I've just sat in the British Library and pored over them feeling nauseous. And this is before I ever even had a miscarriage because he blamed women for so many different things. But the one that I referenced in the previous episode that I'll say quickly for people who didn't hear that, if you're squeamish, forward by 30 seconds, he applied leeches to a pregnant woman's cervix. This was actually fairly common.
Well, they love to leech things.
They love to leech things. Like, anything that seemed maybe wrong, they're just going to bleed it. And then the next day, she miscarried. And now,
surprise.
Like, surprise. I mean, we can't say for sure
that's what caused it.
But we can – it certainly didn't help the situation, right? And he wrote publicly about this experience in the newspaper saying he had told her to – and this is a quote. I remember the exact words. He had told her to keep quiet, but she had gone out dancing. So this was a way of controlling women.
What was she supposed to do? Just like stay
out? Do nothing? But so that's the thing. Things that people, because I know so much about this, and this is not just this one doctor. Like, I could name doctors on both hands easily. Some of the things that were believed to cause miscarriage, and it's so interesting because of your statistic now, the very most common one was nerves. Mm-hmm. So what we're calling stress
Hysteria.
Yes, hysteria. Can you explain hysteria really quickly?
Yeah, so if you're familiar with the term hysterectomy, right, that rude word of hyster, or to be, we think of it as being nuts or crazy, right? Especially when applied to women, is directly related to female anatomy, right? So that the hormones in your body that come from your uterus make you hysterical. So
yes, exactly.
Hysteria was often a term that landed women in institutions.
In mental institutions or in things like in the book, The Yellow Wallpaper.
Charlotte Perkins Gilman.
You know, Charlotte Perkins Gilman, she's great. And she, the woman in that story, is trapped in this room with yellow wallpaper.
Her husband's a doctor.
Her husband's a doctor. And he has prescribed the rest cure, which means she is not allowed to move. Like, she's in bed. She can't read books. She can't do anything.
And you know that ostensibly she's suffering from postpartum depression because she's had the baby.
Exactly. Yeah. In that instance, that's what's happening. But so what was labeled hysteria? At that point in time,
she's not allowed to write, draw, sing
anything,
just sit in the room.
Got rid of what women were allowed to do and equates to things that we might now, just a few examples, and there are probably thousands of possibilities, but things like generalized anxiety disorder, depression, honestly, even way lower scale, like quote unquote misbehavior of women was enough to get you labeled.
I would straight up be institutionalized.
Oh, 100% me too. Like we would be in an institution.
Maybe we could just like have a room next door to each other.
Out of yellow wallpaper. Like, thank God we were not Victorians.
So what else besides like leeches?
Okay, so.
And dancing.
And can't dance, dancing. Right? Oh, right, because he said dancing. So the number one was nerves.
Okay.
And that was saying like, we think women, we just think you're too nervous. And it was similar. They weren't put on like a rest cure sort of prescription, but they were basically told like, don't do anything at all.
Quiet.
Don't read, don't dance, don't play the piano. Like, well, what are you supposed to do with your time? I think sewing was still allowed depending on the doctor.
Cool.
Yeah. So that's great. But yeah, I mean, it was things like nerves, dancing. I have seen specific examples in newspapers from the time blaming women for carrying laundry, for riding horses. Actually, in a George Eliot novel, in Middlemarch, there's an example of that. A woman loses a pregnancy and everyone says, oh, she shouldn't have ridden that horse. And they were like, she's such a bad mother, like really judgmental about it. And then, you know, other simple things like going up and downstairs. Most of the time, pregnant women were allowed to like go out walking, just basic general stroll. But sometimes if anything was going at all wrong, their doctors would even tell them not to do that, like, don't go walk in your garden. Like, it was basically like being put on bed rest, except for far less reason. And the things you were allowed to do while you were in bed were so heavily restricted.
Yeah. Man, I'm dying of boredom just thinking about that.
Exactly. Exactly. And yet what we're hearing from you is that we still believe that stress causes – loss.
Yeah, you're right.
We still believe that carrying heavy things, hello, doing laundry. We still believe that that causes loss. And this is insane because what actually causes loss, can we talk about that really fast?
Yeah.
Real fast. Yeah, just real quick for people who are listening, because maybe you're hearing this and you're not super familiar with pregnancy loss and you're like, well, but don't they? Okay, so the most common cause of pregnancy loss, unequivocally, majority of losses are chromosomal abnormalities in the baby.
Out of your control.
Completely out of your control. It's just what happens. Sperm and egg come together and something goes wrong chromosomally. And typically when we see children who have things like Down syndrome, there's an extent to which we can consider those children kind of miracles because 90%+ of those pregnancies naturally miscarried in the first 12 weeks, and they made it. And so,
is that why most women wait until 12 weeks to announce?
Yeah. So most your miscarriage risk goes down so greatly. And there are a few reasons it goes down. But generally, it's a combination of reaching 12 to 14 weeks of gestation and being able to see a healthy heartbeat and proper growth on an ultrasound. And once you have those two things together, your risk really drastically decreases. Now, I have argued and will argue again. I'm not going to do it right now that we should not wait to announce because I think that's part of what stigmatizes loss. But we'll do that another day. Okay. We'll have that conversation. So most of them are chromosomal abnormalities. Other things are anatomical abnormalities, like things going on in the uterus, a uterine septum, the thing I had where a lot of my uterus didn't get the proper blood flow. But again, born with these things,
right?
Or born polyps. With the hormonal imbalances that cause them, like polyps or endometriosis or things like that. You can't cause it, despite what people love to say on the internet about like all the ways you can make your endometriosis worse. Like, this is something you have.
It just is.
It just is. And it is a medical diagnosis and you can't help it. So that's another possibility. And then there are also some immunological things and some endocrine system things. So actually fertility specialists who we see are called reproductive endocrinologists because they're looking at our endocrine systems. They're looking at our thyroid hormones. They're looking at all these things. And the immunological stuff is really still kind of early in its research. So it's some of it's proven, some of it's considered pseudoscience. Some doctors like it, some don't. But like there's something there. And also the science isn't there yet, but there are some epigenetic things going on. I'm not going to pretend I can explain that. But basically what my doctor told me when I was going through recurrent loss is he said, you only have a 50% chance of getting an answer as to what's happening. And if you're in the lucky 50%, which I was, great. And if you're not, it doesn't mean nothing's wrong. It just means science isn't there yet.
Yeah. What's the term for that?
Oh, okay.
It's on the top of my head.
So there's unexplained infertility.
Yeah, that's what I'm going for.
So it would be unexplained recurrent miscarriage. Or that's actually not the term, but I'm going to hold off on that for another episode. So it's close enough. All right. So those are the things that actually are causing these losses, right? And so when people are telling us to just relax, they're making us feel guilty and blamed.
For things we literally can't control,
but makes us wonder if we can control it. So I really want to talk about something because I've spent so many years in therapy because I do have generalized anxiety disorder with panic attacks. And so like learning to understand my brain and manage my panic has been a huge one of the most pivotal things in my adult life, like recurrent miscarriage, postpartum anxiety, being a mother, and panic attacks and anxiety are like some of the more defining things in my adult life. I think you can identify with some of this, right?
Yes. Shout out to girlies experiencing mental illness.
Yes. Major shout out to our mental illness mamas. It is okay. And also, if you're not a mama or you don't consider yourself one, still cool.
You're welcome here.
We love you. You're okay. You do not belong in an institution with people calling you hysterical. So what happens? I think this is really important. We've talked about how saying just relax makes people feel like they've done something wrong. It adds to that self-blame. It also adds to this feeling of isolation because you feel like this person just doesn't get me. But what happens to your brain when someone says, just relax? So let's just create a scenario here, okay? Totally fake scenario. Let's say that you are having a panic attack and you don't have to have a reason to have a panic attack, so I'm not even going to give one. I just want people listening to know panic attacks don't necessarily come with like a clear reason. Sometimes they do. Sometimes they just happen, and there are so much behind that. So let's say you're having a panic attack. You don't necessarily know why. You knew you were overwhelmed. You were already feeling anxious. Your steam pipe is feeling pretty full. And probably what happened is you just kind of blew the gasket off the top of the steam pipe and you're panicking. So let's say the thing that triggered the panic attack was that you were cooking dinner and you spilled the pot of soup on the floor.
Yes, that seems like it would do it.
Yeah. So you're not having a panic attack over spilled soup.
No.
But that's the trigger on top of the other million things. And you start just melting down, okay? You're hyperventilating. You're so upset. You can't bring your body together. And then your partner, Amy, comes in. Mm-hmm. And she says, Sarah, why are you making such a big deal out of this? It's just soup on the floor. Mm-hmm. Amy wouldn't do that.
No, she wouldn't.
But she's so lovely. Let's say she did, okay? Yeah. She says, Sarah, it's just a pot of soup. It's not that big a deal. Calm down. What happens to your brain in that moment?
Just five alarm bells. Just
five alarm bells.
Yeah. That scenario, you telling me that, makes me just want to get up and run out of this room.
Exactly. Like, yeah. Sorry.
No,
it's don't fine. Run out of the room. But like, yeah, it's the five alarm bells. Because so this is how my therapist and I talk about it, and we've kind of come up with this together. Is, you know, he basically says there are two parts of your brain. There's the conscious and the subconscious or unconscious, depending on the school of theory you're coming from. And the conscious is where we make decisions. The conscious is where we say we're going to make soup for dinner. We're going to put the soup on the table, on the stove. We're going to put a spoon in the soup. And the subconscious is the one that keeps us alive.
Right.
And so that's where our fight, flight, or freeze instinct comes in. It's where we react from. And if we have anxiety, it's where our anxiety is coming from. If we have guilt, it's where our guilt is coming from. All of these emotions, they are coming. So you've got these two different parts of your brain. And what he says to me is these two parts of the brain do not speak the same language.
I believe that.
And so what I always imagine, and this is like an actual visualization that I do if like someone says this to me and I'm trying to understand why I'm getting so hyped up, I love to visualize different things. And I kind of see two little bitty brains on top of my head.
Wait, this is what you imagine when someone says just relax?
Not just relax specifically, but yes.
Or actually, just something that like triggers
if
that.
They say something that triggers that like, oh my God, you're trying to rationalize my emotions and it's making me feel anxious. Mm-hmm. I try to picture what's actually happening in my brain so that it helps calm me down. It's a great diffusion technique for me. So what I imagine is that my unconscious brain speaks English. And you know how, like, when you try to read, like, Shakespeare, people say, oh, it's hard to read Shakespeare because it doesn't sound like normal English?
Sure. Okay. But it sounds just enough like it.
Right. Because it's what we call early modern English. Right. If you try to read Chaucer.
You're really screwed.
Which is old English. It's not even the same language. Right? So you've got, like, this totally different language of English. So I've taken this million steps further. And I have decided that the rationalization someone is trying to place on me is ancient Mandarin. So, like, someone who understands Mandarin now wouldn't be able to understand a single word. And it's a language I'm so not that familiar with. And I'm just visualizing this, like, one brain that's the rational, conscious part of my brain that this person is talking to, screaming at the other part in ancient Mandarin. And the part that speaks English, all it's hearing is someone screaming at it in a language that doesn't, like, it doesn't even recognize the sounds. Not only does it not get the words, it doesn't even know what the sounds mean, but it's yelling and it's like, fire, 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 fire. And I think there's an extent to which this is what we're doing to moms when we say things that blame them. Now, maybe they don't have anxiety. Maybe it's not this intense.
You can still internalize it, though.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So I think we're telling them something rationally. We think it's rational. It's not rational that, oh, you should just relax. That's not rational. Irrational. It's not definitely a rational thing to say. But our rational brain is taking it and saying, wait, is this rational? Should I think that?
It's gaslighting.
Oh, my God, yes. And if your conscious brain decides that that is potentially a rational thing, it's going to start screaming about it to the subconscious brain, and you're going to feel more and more worked up and more and more
upset. Don't really understand
why. And you don't even know why. You don't know what's happening. So I just think, my gosh, how we need to come to understand ways to do better, right?
Yeah, okay. So if we're not going to say, you know, just relax or, you know, you can always adopt, like, what else should we say? Like,
what else should we say? So this is something I have talked to a lot of, like, psychological experts on. It's stuff I've talked to my community a ton about because I know my preferences, but I needed to find out if my preferences matched other people.
Sure.
So like, okay.
I have one too. Yeah. Yeah. My favorite is like anyone, right? It doesn't have to be someone suffering from infertility or miscarriage.
Yes.
How can I support you? Right.
Like, how can I support you?
Yeah.
Okay. So
Can I use that one?
Can I problematize that for a minute?
Yeah, sure.
All right, cool. So how can I support you is not bad.
Right.
Okay. It's not just relax. It's not on that level. But when you ask someone how you can support them, what you're doing is you're asking them to carry that mental load of deciding what they need. And when we're in times of
when the five alarm bells are going off, you can't really tell, right?
You can't really tell. But also, this is something that Dr. Lori Johnson is amazing. And I was talking to her about this recently and what she said to me that I'd never thought of before. She said, when you're in the throes of grief or trauma or some kind of chaos in your life, which could mean pregnancy loss, it could mean fertility treatments, it could mean any plethora of things. She said, the hardest thing to do is meet your basic survival needs. Mm-hmm. Just getting out of bed, taking a shower, having clean clothes, choosing your clothes, choosing your meals, cooking that food. If you have living children, getting them through their days, like just those basic survival needs are so hard to meet in these moments. And what you're asking someone to do who can't even figure out necessarily how to feed and dress themselves throughout the day, how you can help. And that's too much of a question. So what I instead like, and she also really said some good things about, was offering some specific things. And you're Southern, so I know there are specific things you offer, right?
Yeah, like, do you need a meal? Do
yes.
you need a house cleaned? Can I pick up your kids from school?
Yes, exactly. And even thinking about how you phrase that. Because we are so trained to say no. I'm fine. We don't want to be an encumbrance.
Yeah, if you can just say, like, I want to do something for you. Please pick from this list of three things.
Please pick from this list of three things. Or which of these three things would support you most? Or, you know, we're busy, right? It's not like all support people have time to do all any of three things. So maybe you as a support person mm-hmm. need to pick the one thing that you can do. And let's say as an easy example that one thing is a meal. So you can say, I would like to bring you a meal one night this week. Would that support you?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe even give a specific night. I would like to bring you a meal on this night. Would that support you? So you're not asking if they want you to do it. Mm-hmm. They're just saying yes or no to whether it would yeah. be supportive. If they say no, you've at least opened up a conversation to talk about what might support them.
Right.
If they say yes, then you can even take it a step further. And what I really love is wonderful. You might have to ask follow-up questions, you know, if you don't know someone as well.
Right. Do you have any allergies?
Do you have any food allergies, yeah. any restrictions, things like that? If it's someone you know well, like, don't even go there because it's just more on their plate. If you know I can make them a this and they're going to be happy with it, then just say, great, I'm going to drop off this meal at this time on this day. If there is something you would prefer, please tell me. And then when it's time to do it, a few hours before, hey, everything's ready to go for me to drop off at 5:30. Would you like me to knock or leave it by the door?
Leave it. Always leave it.
Always. Because a lot of people think, oh, I'm coming in and I want to be helpful and I want to be supportive.
You know, sometimes you just need to drop it.
When someone just needs to hermit. But some people really want the hug and the support. So, you know, I've taken things to friends and left them on the porch. And those very extroverted friends have said, oh, I wish you'd just come inside and give me a hug. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, sorry. So I really love asking. I think that's one like super, super, super helpful thing that we can do.
So my next thing that I like to say to people is, because I'm a deep introvert, right?
Like, yes.
I will be sarcastic. I will not talk. You know, I will do anything yes. to kind of deflect the hard conversation. So I like to ask people, do you want to talk about it?
Do you want to talk about it? I love that one. I love that one. And what I also love is whatever their response is.
Yeah, you honor it.
Yeah, you honor their response. But then I would even add, if there comes a time when you do want to talk about it, I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
Or let's say you do talk about it. Telling them afterward, it means a lot that you were comfortable sharing this with me.
Yeah, that you trusted me with that mm-hmm. information.
And if you want to talk about it further, I will always be here. Because sometimes we think, well, I've burdened that person with this once. Or, well, they offered them, but they may not have the space to deal with it now. So I love, like, adding those follow-ups so people know.
Yeah, and I think it's important, too, as the person who's asking, do you want to talk about it? Your job when you ask them that is to listen, not to offer advice, right?
Yes.
Or to offer, you know, solutions to fix it, right?
Yes. Okay. So you're going to help me wrap up beautifully here. So these are things I've been speaking about very recently with both Lori Johnson and Dr. Jessica Zucker, both doctors. And one, what they were talking about, Lori was talking about the importance of listening, the importance of silence, the importance of just sitting with someone in their grief.
Yeah.
And then what space. Jessica added to that is she said, you know, we want to sit with someone in their grief, and we also want to remember that some problems can't be fixed.
No, they can't.
So it's not our job to try to fix them. So I think that's hugely important. We just sit with people. We let them know we're here. We let them know they're present. I actually want to pull up because there are two specific things that people put on our Instagram feed recently that I think are like really, really amazing. And I had never thought of or talked to anyone about. So I just want to throw them out there too. The first one is actually for people who are specifically religious because you hear a lot of God has a plan. Mm-hmm. Everything happens for a reason. And honestly, even if you know someone is a faithful person,
sure. Those are that still can rough.
Yeah. Still be very, very, very hard to hear. So like, please don't say those things. But what someone said that they said, like, I heard a lot of things that were hurtful because people knew I was faithful. And she said, except for this one thing. And this person said, I will hold your faith for you until you can hold it again. And I thought, oh, how beautiful. So I think if you're supporting someone who you know, and it doesn't matter the religion, if they are faithful in any way, that is a gorgeous one. I will hold your faith for you until you can hold it again. Now, please don't say that to someone not knowing where they stand on these things. But, and then this one hit me so hard. This community member of ours said that a six-year-old came up to her. The wisdom of children who don't overthink things the way adults do. She had lost a pregnancy. A six-year-old said to her, you're a good mama. He's lucky that you are his mama, and I'm sorry he's gone.
That's beautiful.
That validation, the acknowledgement of you as a mother, the acknowledgement of the child, using the child's name if they had one. Oh, perfect. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Undefining Motherhood podcast. It's been an honor to share this time with you. Remember, you're not just a listener, you're an essential part of our community. If today's conversation resonated with you, I have three simple requests for how you can help us grow. First, subscribe wherever you listened so you don't miss an episode. Second, we'd love it if you could leave us a review wherever you're listening to this podcast, as that's one of the most important ways we can grow and share our message and community. And finally, we'd love to hear from you. Jump over to Instagram and find us at Undefining Motherhood, where you'll see a post about this week's episode where we can continue the conversation. Thank you for being a part of the Undefining Motherhood community, where together we're making change. Until next time, take care of yourself and each other.